Hello and welcome in.
Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. The electron is one of the fundamental particles within our universe. It was first discovered back in 1897 by J.J. Thomson and has been fascinating scientists ever since. Electrons make up the flow of electricity in our gadgets, are the cores of the northern lights, and most importantly, hold together all the atoms in our world. The study of electrons led to the discovery of radiation, and they were the first particles to be accelerated in machines, which evolved into giant ones like the LHC today. They're still the subject of much research, and that study may lead to a complete rethink of the laws of physics. My guest today is Jack Devlin, a researcher who studies the electron and how its properties may give insight in physics beyond the boundaries of what we know today. Welcome, Jack.
Hi, Carl. Nice to be here.
Good to have you on the show. Before we kick off, we've got a little riddle for everybody to think about. Hello, Miriam. What do we have today?
Hello, science mixers. So today our riddle is, we have a two-sided coin that is unfair, but we don't know how unfair it is. How can we determine something fairly using the unfair coin? So I'll repeat that one more time. We have a two-sided coin that is unfair, but we don't know how unfair it is. How can we determine something fairly using the unfair coin? So if you think you know the answer, then tweet us at Science Mixtape. We'd love to hear what you think.
Yeah, it's a tricky one today. If you get it, then props
I'll be surprised.
To you. Yeah. All right. So first, Jack, let's kick things off with your first song. You've chosen The Kinks and Dead End Street. Why did you choose that?
Well, this is a song that really reminds me of when I was growing up, and my dad. We always used to listen to this in the car, so it's got happy memories for me.
Electron comes from electricity, which in turn comes from the Greek word electron, meaning amber. This is because when you rub amber with silk, it creates static electricity.
Oh, very interesting. So we know where it comes from. But Jack, let's start at the beginning. What is an electron?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. And famously, Einstein said, you know, really, it would be enough just to understand the electron. And I think, you know, over 100 years later, we still don't really understand all of its properties. So normally we think about it as a point particle. It was the first sort of subatomic particle that was discovered. And it has an electric charge, and it has a mass, and it has some other properties like a small magnet inside it. And it also has some angular momentum, some spin. So it's rotating very quickly. And it might have other properties. And that's really...
Right. Okay, so you said it's a... It's a point particle. What do you mean by that? You mean it doesn't have a size, or?
Well, it's hard to say. Really, it's hard to know what you mean by a size. So far, everything that we've done to look at and examine the electron hasn't revealed any deeper structure to it. Whereas other particles, things like atoms, you know, originally we thought maybe atoms were a fundamental thing, but then it turned out they could be broken up and made up of electrons and positrons and protons and neutrons. And then even it turned out that protons and neutrons could be broken up and there were quarks inside them. But so far, no one's really been able to find, you know, any sort of deeper structure. And that's sort of the thing that we're concerned with here, to see is there some, you know, some deeper structure there? Is there?
Right. So it's one of these fundamental particles. It's like we haven't been able to break up the electron into any more constituent parts. That's as much as we get. Mm. And we know all these properties about it. What are the other properties that maybe that you're kind of looking into? What kind of things are you looking for?
So the property that we're really looking into is to try and investigate whether it has a shape. So that it's negatively charged. As far as anyone can tell, that charge is spherically symmetric. So it doesn't matter which way up the electron is. It always looks like it has the same shape. It doesn't have any distortions to the electric field that it produces. But that doesn't have to be the case, you know. It's possible that the shape of the electron isn't perfectly round, and instead it could be slightly egg-shaped, say, you know, one side of it could be sort of slightly pointed. And we're trying to measure, in the experiment that I work on, we're trying to measure to what extent the electron is egg-shaped and how big can we put a constraint on the deformation of its charge.
So when you're saying it's not round, you're not really thinking of the roundness of a thing. You're looking at how this electric field is kind of distributed. If you look at it from a different side, the electric field still kind of looks the same.
Yeah, you can think about it like that. But I mean, often, you know, if you interact with objects, you're, in a sense, what you're doing is you're feeling out their electric field. It's electrostatic effects that are stopping, you know, your hand from going through the table, or when you feel an egg or something like that. That's really what's giving it its shape. So it's not, you know, okay, it's not entirely 100% right, because what we're dealing with here are interactions, and the interactions between an electron and an electric field. But you know, a shape is a pretty good way of thinking about it and having a picture
so,
in mind.
So as far as we know, you know, you're saying that it's probably quite round. Mm-hmm. What would be the consequences of it not being round?
Well, it would have a lot of profound consequences, I think. And it's very interesting because it's connected with something that physicists think of a lot, which are symmetries in laws of nature. Mm-hmm. So that sounds a bit unfamiliar, but really all we mean by a symmetry is just some operations that you can do on a system, or it could be an electron, could be some things coming together and colliding. And after you do that operation, the system is unchanged. So a typical symmetry might be translation symmetry. So you have some interaction or something coming together and colliding, then you move the entire system over to somewhere else and you do the same experiment or you look for the same effect, and nothing changes in the laws of physics. They're symmetric, this operation. And an electron, if it had an EDM, an EDM stands for electric dipole moment. And what that means is it's the simplest possible shape that an electron could have. It's not perfectly spherically round. It's got a small displacement between its center of mass and its center of charge.
Right.
So a dipole moment is just it's physics speak for
not
what
round.
That is.
Not, yeah.
Not round, essentially. Yeah. The simplest way of it not being round.
So these, you're talking about these kind of higher symmetries. It's like kind of not really a symmetry the way that we normally think about it, but it's a symmetry like the laws of physics are the same here as they are 20 miles away.
Yeah, it's in the same kind of class of those symmetries. And so specifically the symmetries that an electron having a shape would break are the symmetry of mirror symmetry, or parity, as we call.
Right.
So it seems so bizarre. You wouldn't even really think that something could be different if you take some physical process, you know, something colliding, coming together, coming apart, or anything you think of, and you just reflect that process in a mirror. So, you know, all of the everything that's left hand becomes right handed, and you know, all the ways
right,
that you normally.
Okay.
So you wouldn't, you know, it seems so bizarre to think that something could behave differently if you were to apply that symmetry. But the really surprising thing is, you know, nature is that bizarre. There are physical processes, particularly processes involved in radioactive decay, that
right.
do break this symmetry. But it would also violate time reversal symmetry. So this is the symmetry that says the laws of physics that govern a process should be the same as in the forward process as it would be for the process if you reverse the direction of time. So if you film the process and then you put the video into reverse, the same set of rules should govern that process.
So, yes, this is like the classic example is these like billiard balls on a table.
Yeah.
They like come together, you play it backwards and it looks kind of the same.
Yeah, that's
so actually you've got a demonstration for that we're going to do in a minute.
Yeah.
But first, let's have a little musical interlude and we'll have your second song. You've chosen Paul Simon, You Can Call Me Al.
Yeah.
Why'd you choose that?
Well, this is a song that I associate with kind of starting to work in the lab properly. And you've got to have, you know, good songs that you put on to keep you in a nice, happy mood when you're working on difficult things. And this is definitely one of those songs.
Why am I soft in the middle now? Why am I soft in the middle? The rest of my life is so hard. I need a photo opportunity. I want a shot of redemption. Don't want to end up a cartoon in a cartoon graveyard. Bone digger, bone digger, dogs in the moonlight. Far away, my well-lit door. Just a beer belly, beer belly. Get these
months away from me, you know. I don't find this stuff amusing anymore. If you'll be my bodyguard, I can be your long lost pal. I can call you Betty, Betty, when you call me, you can call me Al.
The rice mass of the electron corresponds to the same energy that falls on your ear while listening to someone whisper for 8 seconds.
That seems quite a lot, actually.
I would expect the same.
So now we learned that the electron is really, really small. It's one of the smallest fundamental particles. So actually, that's quite a lot of energy. But hey, Einstein was right. So Jack, earlier we were talking about symmetries and how maybe this electron that's not quite perfectly round could break some of these symmetries. And you were talking about time reversal symmetry, and you have a bit of a demonstration for that here. So what have you got?
Well, so I've got two snooker balls, and this is the kind of classic thing, you know, you might remember from school, all the problems that you solved were sort of, you know, two balls come together and they collide and then they fly apart. And the goal of this demonstration is to try and convince you that Newtonian mechanics is time reversal symmetric. So the laws of physics that would govern the two balls coming together, hitting each other and flying apart are going to be the same laws of physics that I could equally well apply to a video of the process going backwards. Right. So the balls kind of rolling together, hitting each other and coming apart. Of course, everything's more complicated than that. You know, real snooker balls have friction and there's other things going on that mean that, you know, it's not exactly going to work perfectly, but you get the idea.
We can have a little look and see if it's convincing. So Jack's going to just kind of throw the balls around in his box a couple of times, and we're going to see if it happens. So, so it's going together. And you can kind of, you can see they go from one side of the box and they hit each other and then they go back off to the other side of the box. You can imagine if you were pushing them from the other side, then it would actually work. So I guess that this time reversal symmetry is quite easy to understand. But you had there was another type of symmetry you were talking about, right? Parity. And that's it's kind of a bit more subtle. But you also have another demonstration for that. What have you got for us here?
So I've got I'm going to pull out the cue ball, and I want you to imagine that this this white cue ball is the electron, and in this we'll start off and we'll imagine that the electron is completely round. Like the cue ball. And I put a little dot on it. And this dot is just so that you can see what I'm going to do next, which is I'm going to spin. I've got a plate.
So Jack's got a plate just so our electron doesn't roll away.
They're tricky things. You've got to keep a hold of them. And I mentioned at the start that an electron has this angular momentum. It's like it's spinning. And it's just a property of the electron that there are two ways that it can spin whenever you try and look at its spin. And that's it can be spinning sort of clockwise. So
we're seeing it go round clockwise. So, you're looking down on it and it's spinning clockwise.
And you can see that the dot's kind of going round clockwise. Mm-hmm. Or it can go anti-clockwise, so like this.
Right. And we call those like up and down, right? So when people are talking about spin, they associate a direction with the spin, right? Kind of like an arrow pointing into a clock face.
Yeah,
exactly. And that so the clock goes clockwise. And the arrow that like denotes that rotation is kind of pointing into the clock.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you imagine taking your thumb, your hand, and you're wrapping your fingers in the direction of which the thing is rotating. If it's rotating, you know, counterclockwise, then with your right hand the thumb points up, and if it's rotating clockwise, then your thumb points down.
It's
you know, that's why it's up and down.
That's if it's round. And what happens if it's not? You have this. You were looking at the parity symmetry, which is the in this case just a reflection in a mirror.
Yeah. Right? So I said that the electron can be spinning one way or the other, and if I take my mirror and I let's come around a little bit here, and I reflect the electron in the mirror, you can see that all that does is it changes the direction in which it's rotating, changes its from rotating clockwise to rotating counterclockwise.
Right.
But I already said that the electron, you know, is perfectly happy rotating either way. Those are two states that it can be in. Yeah. So the electron with its spin doesn't violate parity symmetry. Symmetry is a good parity is a good symmetry of this electron.
Okay. Yeah.
But what happens if I give the electron a shape? So I've got a little bit of blue tack here. Let's imagine this little bit of blue tack is its deviation of its shape.
Okay.
And let's just imagine that this is now like how the electron comes. So if it's spinning clockwise, this sort of bit of blue tack here is on the top like this. So it's sort of spinning around, spinning clockwise. And now you can see that the mirror reflected electron is now no longer the same as the original electron, because the blob has stayed the same at the top, but the handedness of the rotation has changed. So the blob that previously, if you imagine it was sort of in the same place as your thumb was when the thing was rotated, has now gone to the other side of the electron. So this now, this parity, this mirror reflected electron is a different electron. It's one where the shape isn't sitting where your thumb is, it's sitting at the other side.
Okay, and so when it's completely round, there's no shape, this rotation can swap.
Mm.
But when you give the electron some shape, you give it some distortion from being round, when you reflect it in the mirror, it's no longer the same as it was before.
That's right, yeah. And what that means is, well, that maybe that's just the way it is, but then that means that you've now got four electron states rather than two electron states.
Right.
And we know from the way the periodic table goes that you can only really have two electron states. So something's gone wrong. And what's gone wrong in this case is that nature has chosen one particular way of the shape and the spin combining and has broken parity symmetry if the electron has a shape.
Right, so. Okay. And so this breaking of parity symmetry is actually quite important, right? Because you were saying that before when we were talking that actually this parity symmetry breaking kind of explains why we're here.
Yeah, so one of the most fundamental questions you might want to ask is, you know, can we take all the physics that we know about and can we start at the beginning at the Big Bang and can we get to us here today? But there's a point where it doesn't work so well, and that point is when you try and create enough matter in the universe. So most of the physical processes that we know about seem to create equal amounts of matter and antimatter. And if that was the case, combined with the properties in the early universe, then everything should have kind of come together and annihilated, and there shouldn't really be anything left. And but obviously we're all here and there is a lot of matter in the universe.
So obviously that's not the case.
That's not the case.
Everything didn't just annihilate.
Sure. So there's something missing. And one of the things that people think might be missing is an additional source of basically time reversal symmetry breaking. So that's what you need. Some additional source of time reversal symmetry breaking that will give you a difference between matter and antimatter production. They're sort of connected together. And if the electron has a shape, then that would be telltale evidence that we found a new source of time reversal symmetry breaking. Whatever's giving the electron this shape, whatever process, whatever interaction, whatever thing that's going on, that would violate time reversal symmetry. And that could also be the thing which explains why
we're all here.
Wow,
so. Amazing. Okay, so Jack, I mean, let's have your third song. You've got you've chosen Mansard Roof by Vampire Weekend. Mm. Why did you choose this one?
This is another lab song, but this reminds me of a summer of third year when my physics tutor kindly let me come and work in his lab for the summer. And this is really the sort of starting point of my experimental physics. I wasn't really an experimentalist before this, but this is a song that we had on sort of solidly throughout that summer. And so it's like kind of getting into physics for the first time and finding out it's fun to be in the lab.
I see a mansard roof through the trees. I see a salty message written in the eaves. The ground beneath my feet, the art garbage and concrete. Now the tops of buildings, I can see them too.
Old-fashioned CRT, cathode ray tube televisions evolved from the devices that were first used to discover the electron.
Jack, you've been giving us a little introduction into what the electron is and how you're trying to measure that, whether it's round or not, and how the consequences that have. I mean, how do you go about doing that?
Well, the first thing to say is it's tricky working with the electron by itself, because the experiment that you want to do is you want to sort of put the electron in an electric field and see its behavior change because of its shape, change from what you're expecting. But if you use just the electron by itself, then that's a difficult thing to do because the effect is so small. And you'll just be dominated by the electron's negative charge moving in the electric field. So
because it itself is charged.
It itself is charged, yeah, exactly. So to get away from that problem, you use an electron in some neutral substance. And for various complicated reasons, it helps if that substance you choose contains a heavy atom. So something like cesium, the atom that's used in atomic clocks.
Right.
Or in our case, we use ytterbium. And this is because there's the effect that you're looking for is sort of enhanced if the electron moves close to the speed of light.
Right.
So, but you can go one step better than just using a heavy atom. And that is, you can use a heavy atom bonded to another atom to create a diatomic molecule. So what this bonding does is it creates a really strong internal electric field inside the molecule. And that electric field can be thousands of times larger than the largest possible field that you could apply in the lab. And it's a lot easier to work with. All you have to do is turn on a more manageable field, which might be, you know, 1,000 volts, or so in some experiments, even just a couple of tens of volts. And you can get an effective electric field, which is, you know, billions of volts inside.
Right. So you're not just using an electron on its own, you're using the electron inside a molecule.
That's right, yeah.
And so what do you do with that electron?
Well, what we do is we start with this molecule. So in our case, it's a molecule called ytterbium fluoride. So ytterbium, which is sort of like calcium but heavier, and fluorine. And what we do is, this isn't the kind of thing you can buy in a bottle, unfortunately. It'd be lovely if it was.
Right.
We have to make this, first of all. So we make it by blasting a laser onto some ytterbium metal strip. And that laser reacts with some gas that we put in there, and that produces some of this ytterbium fluoride. And all of this takes place inside a vacuum chamber, which is just a big steel can where the pressure inside is lower than the pressure of deep space. So no molecules. So everything can happen without colliding with other molecules and reacting, because this ytterbium fluoride is very reactive, and it wouldn't stick around for very long if it was in atmosphere.
Okay.
So we make it inside the can. It flies up through the vacuum can. And as it flies up through the can, we blast it with a whole load of different laser beams, radio frequency waves, and we apply electric and magnetic fields to it. And what these laser beams and magnetic fields and all the rest of it do, they don't destroy the molecule, but they rearrange its internal state. Particularly, we're concerned here with the internal state of the outermost electron, the most weakly bound. If you imagine this sort of solar system model of an atom or a molecule, the one that's orbiting kind of furthest from in the highest energy level, that's the one we're sort of manipulating here.
Okay, yeah.
And we use some laser beams and some radio frequency waves to sort of point all the molecules in a particular direction inside an electric field.
Mm-hmm.
And then we wait a little while. And what we're waiting to see is, do the molecules twist a very small amount in this electric field as they're flying up through the machine? And if they twist a little bit, then that's because of the interaction between the dipole moment and the electric field. And if they don't twist, then nothing's happening. The electron's perfectly round.
Okay. So you've got this electron in a molecule. You create it using a laser, and then you kind of point it in the right direction using an electric field, and then you shine it with more lasers, and you kind of see if that molecule kind of twists round. And if it does, that's the consequence of the electron being not round, essentially.
That's essentially it, yeah. So it's very exciting. Somehow we started off with super high fancy physics, and we were relating it down to a practical measurement that you can do in the lab with the molecule. But all of it depends on the electron having this particular shape, and if it doesn't have this shape.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. You can have these big concepts. Why are we here? And we can take that down to, does the molecule twist after we've done all this stuff to it?
Exactly.
That's pretty amazing. Okay, let's have your fourth song. You've chosen the Postal Service with Nothing Better. Why did you choose that?
Sometimes you get to travel when, you know, you're working in physics and that kind of thing. And this reminds me of a trip that I did to Washington for a conference. So. Thank you.
is not because of atoms touching one another, but merely due to the repulsion of the electrons in the floor and the electrons in your feet.
News.
Antiprotons hint at dark matter.
Ladybird's transparent shell reveals how it folds its wings.
Plastic-eating worms solve our recycling problems.
Beaker people invaded Europe 4,500 years ago.
You can have a smaller star than we thought.
Ooh. So I want to hear about the smaller star. Let's go for that straight away. So what do you mean? Our stars are massive for a start, right? So how can we have a smaller star?
Sure. So there's a sort of smallest size at which you can a star has enough kind of gravity to bring together the hydrogen, helium, and so forth, and have fusion.
Right.
And but because it's a small size, these stars don't burn very brightly. So it's difficult to know exactly, you know, where that cutoff point is. And researchers have recently completed an exhaustive sort of 10-year-plus study of binary and trinary, I suppose. I don't know what they call it.
Triary? So this is like two stars orbiting each other, or three stars all orbiting each other?
Exactly, yeah. Where they're very, very weak, and they're kind of at this boundary between, are they a star or are they a brown dwarf? And by making very careful astronomical measurements of these systems, they're able to determine exactly at what point a star can be massive enough to actually be a star and not be just a big sort of sad failed.
Sad failed star.
Yeah, exactly.
Brown dwarf.
But it's kind of fun because, you know, people obviously work these things out, calculated them, but you actually had to go out and do a proper measurement. And when you did that measurement, it was, you know, slightly smaller than people were expecting. So.
Well, that's quite nice. So there are diddy stars out there.
Yeah.
Miriam, you were doing this thing. This is really cool. They made a new shell for a ladybird?
Okay. So we all know that ladybirds have that red spotted case that essentially stores their wings. So scientists wanted to see how these wings fold into those spotted shells. So ladybirds have long transparent wings that fold underneath their spotted wing cases called elytra. So Kazuya Saito and co. from the University of Tokyo created a clear prosthetic wing case that they could see so that they could see how the wings were folded. So the team used a UV cured resin, much like the material used for long lasting nail polish, and molded it like a real ladybird wing case. So the team of scientists fastened the artificial wing case onto a ladybird that was given anesthetics, and then used a high speed video camera to watch the insect fold its wings. So they found out that that prominent veins along the edge of the wings allow creases to form and fold the wings away in a complex origami-like shape. So ladybirds effectively use flexibility and elastic behaviour in the structures and achieve complex transformation by very simple structures, says Saito. So this folding mechanism could help us build solar array paddles that unfold themselves in space, foldable wings for small vehicles, or even lead to better umbrellas, all just from a ladybird.
Oh, better umbrellas. That's what we need.
That's all we need.
I do not know how someone has not designed an umbrella that doesn't break almost immediately. But I think that is so cool. They actually replaced the wing cases so they could see what's going on.
Yeah, so it was clear. And then you could see the wings basically unfold and how they were folded inside the ladybird. And there's a video online as well, so I'll tweet that out.
Oh, yeah, definitely do that. And so I was reading up about this beaker people. Okay. So this is apparently the study by a team at Harvard Medical School. They seem to suggest that the UK population, or the native population, was displaced around 4,500 years ago by a group of people that came from Europe. And this is about the same time that there was a big increase in these kind of bell-shaped jars that were being found. And the researchers did some DNA sequencing of local populations and of human remains found kind of near the bell-shaped beaker sites. And they found that these beaker people were ethnically different from the people who built Stonehenge you know, around kind of another like Neolithic sites across the UK. And they might have displaced almost 90% of the population, according to their studies. So, I mean, that's just, I think it's amazing that so long ago, we were still getting this mass migration of people from one place to another, and to the extent where they replaced 90% of the population.
Was it with the beakers the secret of their success?
I don't know, possibly. They do look like these upside down bells. They're quite funny. But apparently they started appearing all over Europe, so they don't really know. Cool. And Jack, what else did you have?
So I had this story that I...
the moths, yeah.
Yes, yeah. So this was one of these kind of fortuitous things that happens when someone keeps their eyes open. So a researcher, Federica Bertuccini, was working on working with bees, and she noticed that there were these troublesome moths that seemed to gnaw through the wax in the beehive. So she put them all in a bag, took them home, was taking them somewhere to see if she could identify what they were. And when she got round to doing that, she discovered that they'd all eaten through the bag and they were all over her house. And it turns out that these worms are able to eat through plastic, so polyethylene and that sort of thing. And what's remarkable is that they're able to eat through them better than the best bacteria, sort of the best things that we knew about naturally to dispose.
Yeah, because there was quite a big drive of people trying to find, you know, bacteria or fungi or something that will actually dissolve plastic. I know there's some guys doing stuff with mushrooms to try and like see if they can get rid of plastics that way.
That's right.
But this is using moth larva.
Exactly. So, what the researchers found, she teamed up with some researchers in the University of Cambridge, and what they found is that these moth larva are incredibly good at putting holes in bits of plastic, and they can do it very quickly. And then now the next step is to see, you know, what are they doing with this plastic? Are they breaking it down? Are they getting nutritional benefit from it? Or are they, you know, will their waste be toxic after they do it? And is this a useful way that you could dispose of some of these plastic products that, you know, filling up our landfill and...
Getting rid of plastics with moths.
Yeah, exactly.
So the only other thing I found this week was this... things about antiprotons hinting at dark matter. And this is a report from, or it's actually two separate analyses of the detector that's on the International Space Station, which is called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. And the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, it's a particle experiment, and it detects antiprotons that can come from a range of sources. And both groups both found that they couldn't explain the number of particles they observe without including a source of the particles from dark matter. So this is quite interesting. This is kind of a hint at the existence of it. And we're actually going to have Roberto Trotta, who's a physicist who studies dark matter, on the show next week. So tune in for that. I'll have to try and probe him about that. And there's still just like this massive question mark about our current understanding of physics. And I think it's really interesting that these big experiments are starting to unravel that. Well, so that's science news for this week. Jack, your next song is Joaquin Sabina, Así Estoy Yo Sin Ti. Why did you choose this?
I had a song that reminded me a lot of my dad, and this is one that reminds me of my mum, and summer holidays particularly.
Como un pato en el manzanares, torpe como un suicida sin vocación, absurdo como un belga por soleares.
Electrons are a big part of radioactivity. When people talk about beta radiation, they are actually talking about electrons. The other forms of radiation, alpha and gamma, are really helium nuclei and photons.
So see, electrons get everywhere. Jack, we've been talking about some fascinating research, and this experiment, it kind of employs similar techniques to like atomic clocks and things like that. Are there any, you know, immediate applications of these kind of machines that you're building?
This work directly, you know, this machine itself is really just to measure the electrons. So it doesn't, you know, in itself, it won't have any direct applications. But by discovering these new properties of the electron, we might well end up changing our understanding of fundamental physics. And in doing so, that might lead to all sorts of discoveries that we haven't thought of yet. And the other thing to say is, you know, so many of the things that we take for granted in the world today have come about because of past physicists trying to do the types of measurements that we're trying to do in the lab I work in, which is trying to make ever more precise measurements of atomic and molecular properties. So whether that's lasers, whether that's GPS and that sort of thing, atomic clocks that underpin the standard of time, and, you know, even like kind of byproducts, like things like the whole, you know, computers and the internet and that sort of thing.
And all like of these television, right? From it comes from a cathode ray
exactly.
tube, which was kind of first developed. That was a fact we had earlier.
Yeah.
So these, you know, there are these applications to this, you know, blue sky research, which kind of is just, you know, investigating. Let's see what happens.
Exactly.
Let's see if the electron is actually around.
It's solving these problems that you come across to try and make these measurements. You develop all this extra technology, and that technology often ends up being incredibly useful because someone else spots, you know, I can use that to, you know, make a laser, or I can use that to, you know, Blu-ray player or whatever.
Definitely. Oh, so, I mean, Jack, it's been so fascinating, and thanks for coming in. We've just got time to reveal the answer to our riddle, don't we, Miriam? What have we got?
So let me just remind you what the riddle was. So it was, we have a two-sided coin that is unfair, but we don't know how unfair it is. How can we determine something fairly using the unfair coin? So Kyle's going to have to help me out with this one, but I think it's that you you flip the coin, and then if you get two heads, you flip the coin twice.
Flip the coin twice, yeah. So the thing is, this coin's like unfair. It could be like a 60-40 chance of getting heads or tails, or like a 70-30. So the key is to flip the coin twice.
Okay.
And then if you get two heads, you just ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you get two tails, then you just ignore it. But if you get a heads, then a tails, then that's heads.
Okay.
And if you get a tails, then a head, then that's tails.
Cool.
And so this is this idea that actually, like, even though the probabilities are uneven, doing one then the other is the same as doing the other then one. Mm-hmm. So they actually end up being the same.
Cool.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Wow. So, Jack, if people want to follow along to the electron EDM experiment, you guys have actually got a Twitter handle, don't you?
Yes.
What is it so that people can follow along?
It's at YBFEDM. That's the one I said. Yep.
At YBFEDM. Cool. Yeah. So you can follow along there. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram at Science Mixtape, where we've put up pictures of all the experiments we've done today. And if you'd like to listen again to this or any of our shows, they're all up on Mixcloud, or you can download the podcast from iTunes. If you enjoyed the show, leave us a review. It helps us a lot. And so, Jack, thanks again for coming in. And we're going to finish up with your next song. Why did you choose Night Call by Kavinsky?
This is a song that Sharina and I, my girlfriend, we both really like. And it's really, I can't really do science without friends and partners and family. And so this is sort of for her and for both of us.
Brilliant. So thanks and goodbye. And this is Night Call by Kavinsky.
Tell you how I feel.